On this week in enterprise tech, people are still wondering what's going on with 5G. We talk about how organizations are actually seeing performance degradation when they move to it. Not good. We'll talk about it. Plus, have you thought about how you can defend yourself and your organization from deep fakes? Well, Curtis will take you through it. And is your organization interested in modern serverless architecture and leading frameworks? Well, Brian Kernis and I talk with a great guest today, Guillermo Rausch. He's the founder of Vercel and has some creative ways for seamless workflows for you. Plus, he is also the creator of Next.js and one of my favorite React frameworks. You definitely shouldn't miss it. Try it on set. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you from LastPass Studio. Securing every access point in your company doesn't have to be a challenge. LastPass unifies access and authentication, making securing your employees simple and secure, even when they're working remotely. Check out LastPass.com/twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twit, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 411, recorded September 18th, 2020, your Next.js workflow. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by LastPass. Let LastPass improve your employees' experience while safeguarding your businesses from cyber threats. LastPass is the number one password manager. Visit LastPass.com/twit to find out how they can help you. And by Melissa. Like expired milk, 30% of your customers' data goes bad each and every year. That's money down the drain. Visit Melissa's developer portal for free access to data quality APIs, demos, and code samples. Freshen up your sour data today with 1,000 records clean for free at melissa.com/twit. And by Salesforce Service Cloud. Salesforce Service Cloud is the world's number one customer service platform that empowers organizations to deliver service from anywhere, from home, in the office, or in the field. Go to bit.ly/Salesforce for Service to find out more. Welcome to Twit, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I'm your host, Louis Maresca, your guide through this big, giant world of the enterprise. But I definitely can't guide you by myself. I need to bring in the professionals, the experts in their field, starting with our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin. He's the senior editor over there at Dark Reading. Curtis, I hear you're gearing up for some conferences coming up soon. How are things going for you?
Well, things are going well. Fortunately for me, the bad guys aren't taking any time off, so that gives me plenty to write about. A couple of conferences this week, actually, one from Gartner and one by the Air Force Association. Some interesting stuff coming out of both of those that I'll be writing about in the coming days. And getting ready for Interop in 2 weeks. It's going to be online, completely virtual, but completely useful. We got some great sessions coming up. I'm already watching some of those being pre-recorded, and I think it's going to be a lot of fun. Miss sharing human space with people, but we'll try to do the best we can to make it lively and interesting anyway.
Looking forward to it. You know, I'm actually noticing, is this the same with Interop where some of the organizations and they're trying to stream down or slim down the content to be more focused? Are you seeing that with Interop as well?
It is a little bit slimmed down, although we're trying very hard, I think, to make sure that what they're doing is sort of skimming the cream off the top, the things that have traditionally been the most useful, the most requested, concentrating on those and trying to make sure that the experience is just as good as it can be for the folks who do show up. Because what we're seeing as well is that there's not a lack of interest in these conferences. People are eager for the experience and eager for a really good experience. And that's what we're seeing, a lot of experimentation around, a lot of people trying different ways to put on different virtual events. And I think some of them, frankly, have been doggone successful.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, fantastic. Well, folks, speaking of busy, we have Mr. Brian Chi. He's our geek in paradise, and he's also our packing mogul. Chibert, how are things, and how are the packing? How's the packing actually coming for you?
Packing's going great. Big, big shout out to the folks at Instructables. They had a great Instructable on how to build shipping crates. So I did an order from Home Depot, They delivered it to my car. And this weekend, I'm going to be building packing crates and using that purple insulation foam for packing so that, you know, things that no longer have boxes will actually make it to Florida, hopefully intact.
Fantastic, fantastic. Well, speaking of busy, we've had quite the busy week in the enterprise. People are still wondering what's going on with 5G. Now, some organizations are even seeing performance degradation from their backup systems. Not good. We'll actually go with, through with actually what's going on there. Now, have you thought about how you should defend yourself against deep fakes? Well, Curtis is going to take us through that. Plus, is your organization interested in modern serverless technology and leading frameworks? Well, our guest today, Guillermo Rausch, he's the founder of Vercel and has some creative ways and a seamless workflow for you. Plus, he's also the creator of one of my favorite React-based frameworks, just Next.js, so I'm looking forward to that. But before we get into all those great things, we have to go through this week's Enterprise Blips. So let's get started. According to a recent report, Iranian hackers, most likely employees or affiliates of the government, have been running a vast cyber espionage operation. Now, the hackers are equipped with surveillance tools that can outsmart encrypted messaging systems. Now, a capability Iran was not previously known to possess, according to two digital security reports released recently. Now, the operation not only targets domestic dissidents, religious and ethnic minorities, but and anti-government activists abroad, but can also be used to spy on general public inside Iran as well. Now, this was written by Checkpoint Security Technologies, a cybersecurity technology firm, and the Milan Group, a human rights organization that focuses on digital security in the Middle East. Now, in this case, the hackers have successfully infiltrated what were thought to be secure mobile phones and computers. The hackers were able to overcome obstacles created by encrypted applications such as Telegram, and according to Milan, even gaining access to information on WhatsApp. Now, both are popular messaging tools in Iran. Now, the hackers also have created malware disguised as Android applications. Now, a spokesman for Telegram said the company was unaware of the Iranian hacker operation, but that no service can be protected during phishing attacks when someone convinces a user to enter their credentials on a malicious website. Now, the reports suggest significant advances in the competency of Iranian intelligence hackers, and they come at the time of similar warnings from Washington that Iran is using cyber espionage to try to influence American elections. Now, on Wednesday, a federal prosecutor identified two Iranian individuals that said they had hacked into American computers and stolen data on behalf of Iran's government and for financial gain. Now, the hackers appeared to have a clear goal, stealing information about Iranian opposition groups in Europe and the United States and spying on Iranians who often use mobile applications to plan protests. Now, according to a Checkpoint, the hackers use a variety of infiltration techniques, including phishing. Still, the most widespread method is sending what appears to be tempting documents and applications to carefully selected targets. Now, I guess this is true that organizations are only as secure as their weakest link, which is normally their users. That's right. Now, this goes back to many comments and discussions we've had here on TWiT about the importance of user education and training, as well as advanced threat protection. If nothing else, these examples should help you mobilize your organization to get moving to protect yourself.
Well, Microsoft has retrieved its underwater data center and declared it a success. Microsoft retrieved a 40-foot-long, 12-rack, self-contained underwater data center from its seafloor home offshore from the Orkney Islands earlier this summer. The retrieval of the Northern Isles began the final phase of Microsoft's Project Natick research initiative, exploring the concept of deploying sealed server pods just offshore major population centers as a replacement for traditional onshore data centers. Project Natick has been underway for several years. Here on TWiT, we covered the two-month trial deployment of Leona Philpott, the company's first underwater server pod in 2016, and the deployment of the just-retrieved Orkney Isles pod in 2018. The potential disadvantage of sealed underwater data centers is obvious. They have to be very reliable since they can't be serviced on a regular basis. There's a somewhat less intuitive counterbalancing advantage, of course. They don't have pesky humans wandering around inside them, potentially dislodging cables, unplugging things, or otherwise injecting chaos. There are more advantages to these miniature underwater data centers. Seafloor-based pods don't require expensive commercial real estate, and they get nearly free cooling from the surrounding tons of seawater. The logistical advantage could be even more important than the cooling or immediate financial one. It takes significant time and specialized effort to acquire and develop commercial real estate for a traditional data center in a major city, whereas building a sealed pod and deploying it on the seafloor nearby could be considerably simpler and faster. So while this is a little bit more complex than the APC data center in a box or some other data centers in a box from companies like Dell, the concept isn't all that different from those. Big difference is that power is fed in over an underwater cable and data comes in via fiber. The big difference in performance is that heat is bled through the metal walls of the container. Now, that's important because while there are plenty of now ambient temperature data centers, as we all know, electronics tend to like lower temperatures, and the temperatures of the sea floor, say 120 to 200 feet down, much cooler than what you're going to get in most major metropolitan areas. It's going to be fascinating to see what Microsoft does with its next great submarine data center.
Well, for my story, it's all about bullying. China plans a new data policy in response to the Trump administration's bullying. China's government today, well, actually a couple days ago, unveiled a new data security initiative in response to the Trump administration's efforts to cut Chinese hardware and software out of the U.S. tech scene. Quote, it is important to develop a set of international rules on data security that reflect the will and respect the interests of all countries, according to China's foreign minister, Wang Yi. And the Bloomberg and Wall Street Journal articles read the announcement. Of course, it's in Chinese. But anyway, Wang in his remarks said China is willing to contribute its wisdom to building a framework in which participating countries would handle data security in a, quote, comprehensive, objective, and evidence-based manner, quote, unquote, to maintain open, secure, and stable global supply chains. The suggested policy would also forbid governments from accessing data acquired by firms' overseas operations. Basically, what happens in China stays in China and doesn't get shared with the U.S. authorities. Okay, this is unfortunately more of a he said, she said. There's certainly been a lot of evidence of China not playing nice, but there's also been a lot of evidence of the Trump administration bullying. Let's get people to sit down and do something before some idiot starts World War III, please.
Thanks, Brian.
Well, we usually hear about cyber attacks as targeting corporations and organizations in hopes to siphon some ransom from there. Well, ransomware is on the rise, and it's been targeting more and more critical organizations as well. However, did these hackers not think that at some point human life would be in the balance if they keep attacking, well, hospitals? Well, some need to slap the shackles on these people and give them a bit of a Hello McFly, because the latest ransomware attack was at Dusseldorf University Hospital. And according to a German news outlet, RTL report, the ransom note was addressed to a nearby university. Now, healthcare faculties facilities are one of the biggest targets of cyber attacks. Now, cybersecurity experts have warned for years that most hospitals aren't prepared here. Now, they rely heavily on devices like radiology equipment that are often connected to the internet. Now, without those tools, they aren't as able to handle threats to patients. Now, unfortunately, in this case, a woman in Germany died during a ransom attack of hospital, and what may be the first death directly linked to a cybersecurity or cyber attack on hospital. Now, the hospital couldn't accept emergency patients because of the attack. The woman was sent to a healthcare facility around 200 miles away. Now, even though attacks that targeted patient data, it also didn't directly impact medical devices, but actually could hurt patient outcomes. Now, this results from a study that found that hospitals' death rate from heart attacks goes up in the years after a data breach. That's probably because hospitals have to divert resources to respond to the attack or upgrade software in a way that changes how doctors operate. Now, what the hackers don't realize is their ransom attack is now being treated as a homicide here. Now, on that note, here is some food for thought. Although the hackers are at fault here, do you think the hospital and the university should be also held responsible for taking necessary precautions to ensure disaster recovery? Think about it.
Well, I'm going to go ahead and come in with some additional detail on the story that Lou just told, because this is a critically important attack, one that had actual human life consequences. Now, one of the interesting features here is that according to the Associated Press, the hospital was not the intended target of the attack. As a matter of fact, there was a ransom note attached to one of the attacks, and it was aimed at the university that the hospital is associated with. When law enforcement contacted the attackers through the mechanism provided in the ransom note, telling them that they had hit a hospital, they very quickly provided the key to unencrypt the data, although that was too late for the woman who was dead because of the redirection. Now, as far as we know today, this attack took place using a known vulnerability in a Citrix VPN. And it's fascinating because, according to a recent Checkpoint report, 80% of observed ransomware attacks in the first half of 2020 used vulnerabilities reported and registered in 2017 and earlier, with more than 20% of those attacks using vulnerabilities that are at least 7 years old. So while we're never going to minimize this human cost, it's worth saying to all of those CISOs and security professionals out there, make sure that checking on and updating software on a regular basis is a key part of your defense strategy.
Well, NVIDIA has been rolling right along, and this time they're buying ARM holdings from SoftBank, and the price tag's supposedly $40 billion. That's billion with a B. Well, SoftBank has agreed to sell ARM holdings to U.S. chip company NVIDIA for $40 billion, ending 4 years of ownership as the Japanese technology group shifts towards becoming a global investment and asset management powerhouse. Now, I'm not going to bore you with a lot of financial details. That's not the market we're in. So this is going to be interesting because it's going to allow NVIDIA to round out its CPU family and give them more of a platform that's based for single board computers. One begins to wonder what this is going to do for the extremely inexpensive processors that have spawned a revolution in single board market for the IoT world, Raspberry Pi specifically. Interestingly enough, SoftBank is definitely changing how it does business. It was the holding company that in the past have also owned properties like the Interop trade show.
Now, those of you that do web app development probably are familiar with, have heard of Vue.js. Now, Vue has always been a framework that provides a low barrier of entry for people who to begin developing web applications and user interfaces. Well, today is a massive milestone for Vue because it just released its version 3.0. Now, they have 1.3 million users worldwide, and they use a widely diverse range of scenarios, from sprinkling interactivity on traditional server rendered pages to full-blown single-page applications with hundreds of components. Now, this new major version of the framework provides improved performance, smaller bundler sizes, better TypeScript integration. I'm silently cheering there. New APIs for tackling large-scale use cases, and solid foundation for long-term future iterations of the framework. Now, that's 2 years of work, including 30-plus RFCs, 2,600 commits, and 628 pull requests from 99 contributors. The Vue 3.0 core can still be used with a simple script tag, but its internals have been rewritten from the ground up into a collection of decoupled modules. Now, the new architecture provides better maintainability and allows end users to shave off the top to the half size via tree shaking. Now, Vue 3.0 has demonstrated significant performance improvements over Vue 2.0 in terms of bundle size, up to 41% lighter with tree shaking. Now, initial renders up to 55% more faster, and updates up to 133% faster, and memory usage up to 54% less. Now, leading a team of engineers who are building front-end frameworks and platforms, I can tell you every little bit adds to the better user experience, and they've done a really great job here. Also, with its VS Code extension supporting template expressions and props type checking, which uses Vue 3.0's improved internal typing, has made for a great developer experience as well. Oh, and Vue 3.0's typing fully supports TSX, just like React, if that's your preference. Now, it's always great to see frameworks take the leap forward to support a faster and more modern web. Good luck to the Vue.js team and to the great work from them and in the near future. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, the bites. But before we get to the bites, we have to thank a really great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that is LastPass. Now, your IT department has a very large job, very big and important job. More devices, more applications, and there's a much bigger remote workforce out there, all with new threats and regulations make strong security extremely complex. Luckily, LastPass provides your IT with strong security that's easy to use and manage. Now, LastPass surveyed 700 IT and security professionals across a range of industries, from financial services to IT to retail. 82% say their business has been exposed to a risk due to poor identity and access management. Thankfully, LastPass can help you manage identities and promote good security behaviors while your employees are remote. Now, you want your employees to have secure password storage. LastPass gives them their own vault for storing every app and web login they use. They also make it easy and safe for employees to share logins while keeping access to corporate data safe. And also single sign-on, which manages employee access in a centralized view, so IT always has insights into who has access to what and from where. Now, enterprise password management ensures oversight of shadow IT and enforceable policies across all password protected accounts. Of course, multi-factor authentication requires additional factors to prove a user's identity while they use biometric or contextual factors, which makes it the process smooth and easy for employees. Now, employees always have their passwords with them and can gain access from anywhere, no matter where they are, from any device. Working remotely should be more of a convenience, right? Not a frustration. Well, rest easy because that your business is secure with LastPass. Now, they're using AES 256-bit encryption and salted hashes, ensures complete security in the cloud. Now, your data is encrypted and decrypted at the device level, so the data in your vault is secret from everyone, including LastPass. Now, people have their favorite tools, and I can definitely tell you LastPass is definitely mine. It saves me time. It saves me money. I use it so often, I don't even know I use it anymore. In fact, I use it on all of my devices. I use it on every one of my sites, especially the most important ones, like the business sites, the financial sites. In fact, I've enabled Active Directory integration, so I only have to remember that one password so I can use it for all my network logins and access all of my passwords. LastPass is the number one password manager out there. Let LastPass securely manage your users' identity, letting your employees work efficiently without making your business vulnerable to cyber threats. Go to LastPass.com/twit. That's LastPass.com/twit. And we thank LastPass for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's now time for the bites. Now, the bites are where we go a little bit deeper into some of the this week's enterprise and IT news stories. Now, this week, what if I told you that telecom's 5G networks are not even as fast as their 4G counterparts? Would you believe it? I definitely would. Now, I found that turning off my 5G in my area gets me about 30% better coverage, better reliability, and about 10% increase in speed. That's right, 10% increase in speed. In fact, AT&T smartphone users who see their network indicator switch from 4G to 5G shouldn't necessarily expect that they're about to get faster speeds. In fact, in PC Mag's annual mobile networking test, 5G phones connected to AT&T get slower speeds than 4G phones in 21 out of 22 cities. In fact, they concluded that AT&T's 5G right now appears to be essentially, quote unquote, worthless. Now, though AT&T's average download speed of 103.1 megabit per second was nearly as good as Verizon's thanks to a strong 4G performance. Of course, AT&T's 5G should be faster than 4G in the long run. This isn't another case where of AT&T misleading labeling its 4G network as a type of 5G. Instead, the disappointing result on PC Mag's test has to do with how today's 5G phones work and how AT&T allocates that spectrum. In fact, AT&T's 5G slices off a bit of old 850 megahertz cellular band and assigns it to 5G. It gives phones a valid 5G icon without actually increasing any performance. And because of the way its current 5G phones work, it actually, in fact, reduces performance. Now, T-Mobile's 5G wasn't always faster than 4G. And in fact, in Austin, T-Mobile had the most 5G availability of any carrier, but its 5G results were 17% slower than its 4G results at locations where both networks were available. And in fact, in 2019, AT&T said its clearly or early 5G deployments on the 850 band would only offer speeds that are similar to LTE Advanced and a form of 4G that AT&T was misleading called 5GE or 5G Evolution. Now, OpenSignal found average 5G speeds of about 494.7 megabits per second for Verizon and about 60.8 for AT&T and about 49 for T-Mobile and Sprint. So there's some problems here. It sounds like Verizon's got it going on, but unfortunately, their market and their areas are very small. Now, Curtis, I want to throw this to you first, because is this just a case of telecoms wanting to feel like – basically feeling the weight of competition here, and they're trying to pull the wool over the eyes of the consumers and until they catch up?
Well, obviously, 5G has to be at least 1G better than 4G, so we should all run out and buy it. The issue is that not everyone can buy it. And as we're seeing through some of these tests, even those who can may not be getting an advantage. This is two things happening at once. One is that telephone companies are looking for early adopters to go ahead and pay for the larger rollout of 5G. And the other is the fact that we are so haphazard and scattered in our deployment of any cellular technology that we're going to take years to roll out what most other countries roll out in, well, one giant move. So this is something of a cynical move on the part of the telcos. On the other hand, it's a cynical move they've made a number of times in the past. As a matter of fact, pretty much every time they have advanced a generation in technology.
Right. Now, Cheaper, I want to throw this to you because this, in fact, can impact other people's use of some of the other bands, correct, as 5G starts to roll out?
You bet. In fact, I had a very pleasant email conversation with one of the Twilight fans, and he says, quote, "I am a caregiver of a disabled senior citizen. She recently received a notice from Consumer Cellular that her 3G service would be turned off at the end of the year to make way for the new 5G spectrum." So translated, this is a behind-the-scenes indicator that the carriers are aggressively collecting older 3G spectrum to open up spectrum for the 5G channel bonding. Now, keep this in mind. You don't get great speeds on congested cell towers, because when towers are congested, that means you can't do channel bonding. The whole deal is, yeah, the bandwidth has to be there. So because they're trying to play a shell game, they're trying to collect up older, less used spectrum, they're trying to get people to upgrade. I got notices a long, long time ago that I had a whole bunch of 3G modems that I had out in the field collecting data. I got a notice from the carriers, in this case it was AT&T, that I should plan on migrating off 3G as time goes on, because they are going to have to recycle those frequency bands. Now, an interesting side note is that our friends at Spectrum, which typically is a cable company, is playing now in the mobile cellular world. However, they've got a really interesting trick. I don't know if you've noticed, but if you go around large areas, the spectrum, it has a large footprint in, you're going to see white footballs that are hung from cables in various neighborhoods. They're going to have three relatively tiny little stick antennas on them. Those are public Wi-Fi. They were rolled out as part of community support so that people would have public Wi-Fi. But I don't know if you've noticed, a lot of the Wi-Fi performance has been kind of meh, not that great. You know why? Because they have priority networks that require sign-ins that their mobile users are going to be getting onto. That way they have quality of service profiles so that their voice doesn't get degraded. That seems to me, this is purely my speculation, that Spectrum is saying, hey, we're going to be able to give you significantly better performance in all kinds of places where we have a big footprint. And to do that, we're going to be able to give you your performance for less money. So it's almost a variation on the MVNOs like Consumer Cellular. So it's going to be really interesting. You know, 5G is also becoming a problem with the FCC in that the FCC has removed the state's capability of charging and doing more direct regulation on the micro cell installations that carriers want to put onto poles. So this is going to be a really, really interesting rollout, if you ask me.
Right. You know, I like to relate this to the USB Type-C connectors and that kind of program out there, because it has a lot of potential, a lot of use cases, but the market and the manufacturers are just making a mess out of it. And so I think this is very similar, as 5G has a lot of potential, a lot of runway to broaden our horizons and our connectivity and our speeds, but just the manufacturers, the telecom groups, just really making a mess out of it. So hopefully we'll see some improvement soon. Well, folks, that does it for that bite. I do want to jump into the next bite because deep fakes is a super interesting technology, especially for me. And a lot of organizations are really worried about false information being spread about them. Now, Curtis, what do you think? How can organizations protect themselves here?
Well, you know, it is a very interesting topic because there may be no form of AI that's sexier right now than the deep fake. I mean, we're all fascinated by the possibility that someone can create a very realistic looking video, a very realistic sounding audio, or even a social media post that appears to be from an individual and is actually from someone else. Yeah, this is the kind of thing that is the stuff of dystopian science fiction. And we've seen it used a few times in filmmaking when a long or even recently dead celebrity appears in a film in something that looks pretty much real. So what is this all about? Basically, to cut away all of the fluff, it's taking an individual's likeness and teaching AI how to manipulate it, sometimes by mapping it onto another individual's body and making it appear that the individual in question is doing something that they never did at all. Now, we've been hearing a lot about this right now because everyone has been concerned that this year's presidential election might have been hit by a number of deep fakes. So far, that's not the case, but we've still got time. And even away from an election, it's not at all unreasonable to think that an attacker could use a deep fake of a national leader or even a corporate leader saying or doing something that goes against the interests of the organization that they're leading in order to change international policy or alter stock pricing. So what can you do about this? I talked to a number of people for my article at Dark Reading, and the answer today, unfortunately, is not a whole lot. One of the definitions of a good deepfake is that it's something that goes beyond the ability of most people to tell that it's a fake. And right now, we don't have good technology that can identify a deepfake on a consistent basis. The very best that we've seen are systems that can identify a deepfake something around 2/3 of the time. And that was cutting-edge stuff. So what do we do? One of the things that we do is we train our employees and we start training our citizens in what amounts to media literacy. You teach people, starting with the basics, does this pass common sense? Is the deepfake of an individual doing or saying something that is wildly outside their normal behavior, even if it might be within the projected behavior of their enemies? You know, think about your political opponent. If you had a deepfake of them suddenly acting like they were on screen snorting coke, well, that's not usual. That doesn't really pass the sniff test, but it might play into some fantasies and get spread. So you teach people to look for things like that. There are also some tells that are still active in most deep fakes today. Things like the individual on screen not blinking, or there being a sort of odd halo around hair or head or body features. Those are going away as the deep fake technology gets better. But for now, you can look for those. And believe me, the deepfake technology is getting better. Not only that, but it's getting cheaper. Today, a good, competent hobbyist can do a credible deepfake. Now, we've seen these in a lot of ongoing situations, one of them being what we call, a revenge or unauthorized image, where someone, often a celebrity, is shown in an openly pornographic or exceptionally unflattering position. We know that can be done by just about anyone who has access to very commonly available tools. You know, these are not tools that you have to pay a ton of money for. These are not tools that you have to have a 40-core workstation to generate. These are happening. So we need to train people. We need to keep our technology getting better, although most of the experts that I talk to say that it's likely that the deep fake technology will stay at least one step ahead of the deep fake detection technology for a long time to come. The only good news in all this is that deep fakes are not taking over as rapidly as we had feared. Not sure why, but that's one of those things that we can hope will continue for some time. So let me turn to my co-host, Lou. I'm going to go to you first. How worried are you about deepfakes?
You know, I'm not too worried about it. Like you said, the adoption has been pretty slow. And I think that's just because of people having, you know, access to the technology, or even some of the, you know, the built systems that can perform very well. Plus there's a lot of new technology coming out that can actually, like you said, fight against this, that can start detecting these things. And so I think that with that, once you have technology, they can say, oh no, this is not real. Or we can tell that based off the video content, it's definitely not real. Cause there's other videos that are, public that are different, that are basically, you can tell it's faked. And so they'd be able to identify that. And so I think I'm less worried about this. Now, in the short term, what I am worried about is that somebody does get a hold of it and is able to impact things like elections and other things just by a very simple video that might take quite a bit of time for people to detect that it's fake or not. But I think from personal perspective, I'm not worried about it. And even from a business perspective, not really worried about it. But in the same sense, as it becomes more readily available, it might be adopted more, and we'll have to have better systems to target against it.
Better systems to combat it, definitely. And Brian, I'm going to turn to you with my next question. You've dealt over the years with many, many different users of different skill levels. How realistic do you think it is to train lots of individuals in media literacy? Do you think that we could come up with some sort of widely available training that people would take that would really be useful in teaching them how to at least suspect that something was a deep fake.
Give up. That's my basic thing. I've had way too many people saying, did you see what this actress was doing? Or did you see, just what Padre did when he caught me in front of a green screen is just wild. Or have you seen what happened to the Queen when she was wearing a green dress? The technology is there and it's getting really good. And the sad part is because of what a lot of people think. A lot of people just say, oh, that must be real. I saw it on the internet. That's just way too common. And it's sad. But I'd like to counter this. I'd like to counter the technologists out there. I've had access to an Adobe product for a very long time where it's when you sign a document and you send it through multiple steps for multiple signatures. It actually attaches a cryptographically encrypted hash of the document so that if in the next step, so I sign it and then my supervisor signs it. If any little thing is changed, even if it's one pixel, it will then flag as the document has been changed. It doesn't take too much imagination on, we have signatures on web pages. You look for the little lock. Maybe we might need to start thinking about having those locks on news service photos and videos and even stories to make it harder to fake. I don't know. This is maybe this is one of those topics that make you go,
Brian, it's interesting. One of the experts I spoke with used that same idea as a possible solution. She is also a cryptographer and said the idea of essentially signing, hashing and signing images to authenticate them could be a way of helping slow the spread of deepfakes. Well, this is going to be something we're talking about for a long time because, as I said, the technology is getting cheaper, it's getting better, and it's becoming much more widely available. Face it, we're getting entry-level artificial intelligence engines on platforms as small as the Arduino now. And that means that these deepfakes are going to inevitably crop up more and more often and give us more and more to talk about in the future. Well, with that, Lou, I'm going to toss it back to you because I know we have a great guest in store.
Thanks, Curtis. That's right. Next up, we have a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Ride. But before we get to that, we have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that is Melissa. Now, have you ever forgotten to check the date on a carton of milk? I know I have. It's easy to store it away and just forget about it. And like milk, your customer data can also go bad. It can go stinky, sometimes faster than milk. To put it in perspective, up to 30% of customer data goes bad each and every year. Now, think about your customer base. That's a lot of customers. Now, that's when Melissa is there for you. Melissa makes sure your data is accurate. It's current, so you can reach to the right people, your customers. You did the work to make them your customers. Melissa makes it so you can have reliable customer data. Now, if you're wondering how effective Melissa is, just know that they've been helping businesses maintain fresh data for 35 years. Now, Melissa can help you identify your customers and get to know them. Think about how valuable it could be if your organization could add customer or consumer demographic information to your records, such as property and mortgage data, even marital status or social media handles. Melissa will fill in the gaps by adding emails and phone numbers. Now, plus, if you're looking for new customer leads, Melissa can help here because identifying customers and current customers allows you to find new prospective customers through Melissa's prospect database as well. Now, verifying your addresses, your emails, and phone numbers and names in real time is really important because incorrect data entered by customers, simple human error, or even duplicated records makes it easy for bad data to find its way into your system. Melissa can help you verify that data at that point of entry. Now, match and consolidate your records. Melissa's matching and deduplication tools help you uncover, merge, and purge hard-to-find duplicate records for an accurate 360-degree view of your customers. Now, Melissa's flexible deployment options offer different platforms to suit any preference, business size, or budget. Now, with flexible on-premise web services, secure FTP processing, and software as a service delivered options, you can choose the best way to meet your unique business needs. In fact, I've used Melissa's API. It's really, really great API, really well done, and I think it's great for your business to try it as well. Now, Melissa continually undergoes independent security audits to reinforce their commitment to data security, privacy, and compliant requirements. They've had the utmost dedication to your data's security by implementing strong controls and safeguards while processing your data. Now, I probably told you this story a bunch, but you know, I think USPS needs to, Melissa, because I put in a request to redeliver my mail, entered the wrong address because of the auto resolve of the address. It wasn't my address, but the unit down the street. Mind you, I've lived here for 10 years, and guess what? USPS got it wrong. And then they had Melissa, they would have been able to instantly verify and determine the right address for me and that it was a slight misentry. Now, over 10,000 businesses trust the address experts. Trust Melissa to be your foundation for data-driven success. Melissa is supporting communities and qualifying essential workers during COVID-19. See if your organization qualifies for 6 months of free service by just applying online. Don't put up with sour customer contact data. Try Melissa's APIs in the developer portal. It's easy to log on, sign up, and start playing in the API sandbox 24/7. Get started today with 1,000 records cleaned for free at melissa.com/twit. That's melissa.com/twit. And we thank Melissa for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's my favorite part of the show where we actually get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. Today we have Guillermo Rausch. He's the founder of Vercel and also the creator of one of my favorite React frameworks, Next.js. Welcome to the show, Guillermo.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Like I said, I'm a huge fan of Next.js. I also a fan of React.js, and we use it all over Office and a lot of our Office add-in platforms. But before we get into it, can you maybe give us a quick overview in the journey through tech, a bit about Next.js and what brought you to Vercel?
Yeah, for the past decade, we've seen this shift from back-end technology where there's sort of a bit of an overinvestment. When you survey the landscape of enterprise IT, you hear a lot about infrastructure, clusters, Kubernetes, containers. But what makes a great experience for the customer is having a great front-end experience. Front-end is where the visitor first arrives. It's where commercial transactions happen, whether it's buying something or upgrading an account or making a marketing conversion. So front-end really is where all the optimizations are possible, where all the interesting customizable and personalized experience are possible. And we sort of became experts in this field. So my personal story is that I was involved with an open source framework way back in the day called MooTools, started contributing a lot to it. It kind of really took off. Facebook started using it. It inspired a lot of their early kind of client-side front-end infrastructure. And my journey through open source led me to stay in touch a lot with that community and then later realize that I could build a lot of incredible tools for a great developer experience for front-end developers, but also delivering great user experiences for end users at global scale.
Right. Now, really quick, I mean, in the blip section, I talked about Vue.js a little bit. Can you give us maybe a taste of like why Next.js and what was the intent when you were creating it?
Yeah. So technologies like Vue and React started so that you could have an abstraction, which is typically called the component, which has basically lives on the client side, on the front end. It executes on your device. So these components are able to basically do lots of interesting new workloads, like real-time data updates. Every chat application, every real-time website that you use nowadays is using one of these new component engines to power their experiences. Where Next.js really shines is that when you're creating a modern front-end experience, there's a lot of repetitive work that happens. So for example, it's not uncommon to hear that developers have to configure compilers, bundling tools, they have to set up performance benchmarks, performance monitoring tools, they have to set up routers so they can link URLs to their rendering layer. So we noticed that all this repetitive work could give rise to this new category of reactive front-end framework. And Next.js was a very early mover 4+ years ago, and it's gotten this kind of crazy adoption where, a very significant percentage of the top Alexa 1000 and 10,000 are now migrating their .coms to be powered by Next.js. So examples include Apple, Staples, Nike, Adidas, TikTok.com. They're all powered by Next.js because they want to deliver this like super interactive front-end experiences.
Right, you have quite the list, I think, of adoption. I was actually really impressed. We've used it quite a bit. Now, obviously, it lowers that barrier of entry for developers. It gives them the tools that they need to move forward. Can you maybe talk a little bit about how this kind of relates to what brought you to Vercel and like what's happening there and how you can relate to Next.js?
Yeah, so we're just talking about 5G and speeding up the internet at large. And really, it's not just about the developer experience, but developers need to do, at the end of the day, productive work that delivers lots of value for their job and their businesses, right? And one of the things that we identified is that what really moves the needle at scale today is improving end-user performance. So it's not just about what you do with your code, but it's also when you deploy your code, how is that being served to the end-user? So Vercel completes the other half of the equation. When you deploy your modern front-end project to Vercel, we do lots of incredible optimizations like automatically distributing your content throughout the world, what's typically known as a CDN. But on top of the CDN, we build a layer of intelligence for automatically caching and invalidating data. So in other words, everything that you publish to Vercel is highly optimized for this kind of really great end-user experience. That's why among many other industries, we're seeing a lot of progress with e-commerce, where when you're rebuilding your e-commerce front end, the thing that you're caring about the most are these critical metrics like what we call time to interactive, which is first you get the page, and then I want to click buy, and I want to make that really responsive. So Vercel ensures that throughout the entire life cycle of the development of this new front end that you're working on, those critical metrics are met, and that at the end of the day, your business improves.
So when you talk about the kind of the entire process is met, like how is the developer or the developer community, like how are they monitoring this? What kind of tools does it give them to do that?
Yeah, so we give them a comprehensive workflow. It starts with integration into their Git workflow. So most developers nowadays are checking in their code into source control. When they check in their code, that's when Vercel automatically kicks in. So we take your code, we build it, we optimize it, and we give you back a URL where you can test your product in real time. It's really impressive because we're shifting the equation from you're only caring about code and reviewing code to now we're adding this new layer of you can test your code in the cloud. So because we're focused on front end, this we can give this people that are very much concerned with components, with design systems, with interaction, we can give them that missing and very important half of the equation, which is access to an actual live version, a live deployment of their front end. So after they get this live deploy, they can kick in integrations, for example, to monitor performance. A very popular one that we integrate with is Lighthouse, which enables developers to monitor these scores that I just talked about, like time to interactive, and time to first contentful paint. So in other words, how fast your site is painting. And what's really interesting about this integration is Google will soon begin ranking websites, not just in order of like keywords matching your search, but also how fast the website is. And they're evaluating it by those metrics. So Vercel is kind of giving you this workflow where not only do you have a great developer experience, you can integrate into your favorite tools, you can add performance assurance, integrations, and testing, and altogether always be maintaining this kind of level of modern quality and performance.
Right. So we do a lot of ring-based testing where we have to deploy to different rings, and it takes a lot of infrastructure and pipelines to support something like that. One thing that's interesting to me, and I want to know, I'm interested in how this system can support it, is that a lot of teams, what they try to do is they put their code out there and they do test it, but they do performance testing and they verify it most of the time on the machines that they're at. So they're usually pretty fast developed machines that they have. Is this system in Vercel, is it able to actually assist when you say performance testing, performance metrics, like the time to interactive, the time we have something called time to edit. When I was on Dynamics, we built this framework even before React was around, and we had to do this thing where we had to collect, time stamps in there to figure out where the time to interactive or time to edit was. Now, is there a way to do that on machines that are less perform? Like we like to call it the P95. Of statistics of the machines that are out there that are most likely slower and less performant that might give you different results?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is one of the big advantages of this workflow. So first of all, when you run Git push, we give you a URL that is production-like. We call it the deploy preview URL. What's nice about it is that it's already living in the cloud infrastructure that your users will be accessing as well. So it automatically has SSL configured for security, which enables certain web features and already kind of creates a different kind of environment that is more relevant than testing on your local device. And it enables the advanced caching features and optimizations and so on. So right from the start, you're testing against a real-like front end as opposed to testing a localhost. But we take it a step further. When you ship, and we call the Vercel workflow develop preview ship for this reason. When you ship, Next.js can submit back to Vercel web vitals information. So what this means in practice is that you're not just manufacturing performance tests, like testing on your local device, what I call a synthetic test, but after you ship, you can collect data from your actual audience about like how is it actually performing with the devices that are visiting you on the networks that are visiting you. So it's kind of a summary of all the subjects that we were talking about earlier, right? Because maybe some of your users are on old 3G, maybe they're on 5G, maybe they're on Android, maybe they're on iPhone. So by capturing the metrics that matter to your performance of your front end from the device itself, Vercel can inform the front-end developer's journey in a way that's more accurate, more realistic, and ultimately ensures a great level of performance over time. It's not just that, like, oh, we shipped the new front-end, it's all good, we tested it, and then, 6 months later, it regresses. So that idea of giving this front-end developer an amazing workflow that is comprehensive and zero configuration, it's been quite compelling.
Fantastic. When we come back, we have a lot more to talk about. And also, I want to bring my co-host in. But before we get to all that, we do have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Salesforce Service Cloud. Now, you all know I'm really big on CRM. I can tell you that there's a reason why Salesforce Service Cloud is the world's number one customer service platform. It really does empower organizations to deliver service from anywhere at any time. Now, Salesforce Service Cloud wants you to be prepared during these unknown times. They understand that you're trying to do more with less resources, hustling to adapt to new customer needs and innovating your business to respond to the current environment. The goal here is to satisfy your customers, right? Well, that's why you look for platforms that easily meet their needs. Now, Salesforce provides turnkey solutions, but they also have out of the box to fully customizable support. Customization and platforms are near and dear to my heart, and Salesforce does it very, very well. In fact, it really helps you find the best solution for your customers. Now, Service Cloud allows you to rapidly respond to customer needs on any channel. Think about it. You have a ton of channels. You have chat, SMS, WhatsApp, Facebook Messenger, and more from home in the field or at the office. So Salesforce can help you respond here. You can provide instant support with self-service portals. You can connect customers to articles or even account info and community members to help find instant answers for your customers. In fact, work smarter with built-in AI. They have embedded AI-powered chatbots to help resolve customer issues quickly. Now, give your service team the tools to provide an unforgettable customer service experience. Resolve cases faster while using the entire suite of intelligent productivity tools and giving agents a complete shared view of every customer and every interaction. Utilize the capability of personalizing every customer conversation and allow them to respond with the right level of service. Built on a fast, flexible platform, Salesforce Service Cloud enables trailblazers to provide world-class service anytime, anywhere, whether it's messaging, chat, phone, self-service, or even in person. Over 150,000 companies keep their customers happy with Salesforce. Provide your customer service agents with a fast, flexible service platform that keeps them and your customers happy. Go to bit.ly/Salesforce for service to find out how the world's number one service platform can help your business grow. That's bit.ly/Salesforce for Service. And we thank Salesforce Service Cloud for their wonderful support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, we've been talking with Guillermo Rausch. He's the founder of Vercel and, of course, the creator of Next.js. Now, I do want to bring my co-host back in because I've been chomping at the bit here. Cheebert, I want to throw it to you first.
Well, there's all kinds of things that I want to ask, but my big thing is Curtis and I both used to run professional testing labs. I did one for InfoWorld, and Curtis ran a server testing service. And this kind of testing is just not easy. I'd like you to go and tell me a little bit about the testing infrastructure and whether or not I can start thinking, instead of having to build a test bed, you know, I use things like the Maxwell from Interworking Labs so I can simulate a satellite link. I actually keep around old operating systems just so I can go and test them out. Is Vercel starting to tell me I can perhaps give up on that really, really expensive and time-consuming infrastructure because it's now built in?
Yes. And one of the interesting things is that everything we build is completely serverless, meaning it's all managed by us and it's basically infinitely scalable and globally distributed. So we have a couple dozen regions where we distribute your front end. We publish your pages to the edge, such that it's right next to where your visitor is accessing your website or a web application. And when it comes down to testing, we've sort of enabled an infrastructure that allows you to test on so many different layers. So it starts with the developer experience, where you can simulate our entire cloud, basically on localhost. When you're running that dev server, it has every capability that the cloud has. So this has been a common criticism with the emergence of serverless. We're like, oh, now the cloud has gotten so complex that I always have to deploy to actually kind of learn and reverse engineer how it works. So we kind of took care of that with the care into the developer experience on localhost. Then the URL as a center of gravity is the interesting thing here. So think of it as how Dropbox enabled every file to receive a hyperlink when you right-click it and say, like, get me the share URL. We're essentially doing that for every Git commit, where we're basically giving you a share URL for every front-end push that you make. And the interesting thing about this is that, let's say that you're even wanting to do QA. So you've just rebuilt the latest website of twite.com, and you want to hand it off to your QA team, or you want to hand it off to security for a review, or you want to hand it over to marketing for them to early understand how the product works. So all those things used to be basically really difficult. And like you said, a lot of investment went into creating staging infrastructures and separate isolated cloud infrastructures, and then the security problems and software update problems like we were talking about earlier. So all of that goes away, and the developer just focuses on the product and on the end result. And that URL not only enables manual QA, it enables any sort of testing integration on top, like headless browsers, for example. You can simulate browsers accessing that URL, and we're living in a world with so many different devices that we're targeting, with so many different viewport sizes. So testing all of that from the perspective of just code is basically impossible at this point. Like, the developer can sort of imagine and test and resize a window to see like what it'd be on mobile. But the thing that really makes it click is that you get that URL and you can sort of throw it at all the devices that you want to support, and you get the most accurate possible testing.
Okay, I'm going seriously fanboy here. If I'm an organization and I want to take advantage of this, what kinds of homework should I be doing before I give you guys a call?
Great question. So one of the big trends that supports the rise of this new wave of this front-end platform is precisely the division between back-end and front-end that has happened over the last decade. So for a lot of enterprises that have had to make the investment in mobile apps, for example, this is not new. So you had to expose an API just like we're seeing with Melissa, it gives you an API for data. So a lot of companies had to invest in creating APIs that expose their data. Or sometimes they've gone and purchased APIs off the shelf that basically exchange data. So an example of this is the rise of the CMSs that give you APIs, or the e-commerce APIs, like BigCommerce, which just went public, or even companies like Twilio and Stripe and Algolia. So the rise of this API economy is enabling the remodernization of your front end without having to change your back end. So this is really an incredible opportunity. So every company that can model their world as back end and front end is ready for this transition. So they can hop onto Vercel and start remodernizing and improving, vastly improving the performance of their front end layer.
Right. Well, all good things come to end. Things definitely go fast when you have a great conversation. Guillermo, thank you so much for being here. We're running a little bit low on time. I did want to give you a chance to tell the folks at home where they can find more about Next.js and maybe Vercel as well.
Yeah. So Next.js is really great, and great opportunity for people that want to break in into the industry, or even seasoned professionals that want to upgrade their React skills or learn new ways of creating high-performance front ends. So Next.js.org/learn is the absolute best way to learn the basics, and it takes you from zero to hero, basically. And it, as part of that, you'll learn to deploy in the way that I described, where you have your Git repository, you push, and your changes go live instantly on the Vercel network. So I just go to Next.js.org/learn, and I also want to extend an invite to everybody to join the first global user conference for Next.js. So Next.js.org/conf. We've gone virtual, as we were discussing earlier in the show. And one of the most amazing things that happened is that in just a couple of weeks, we got nearly 40,000 registrations. So if you're interested in learning more about Next, it's another great opportunity.
Fantastic. Well, thank you again, Guillermo, for being here. We appreciate your time. Well, folks, you've done it again. You sat through another hour of the Best Dang Enterprise podcast in the universe. So tune your device to TWiD. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to my co-host, starting with our geek in paradise, Mr. Brian Chiebert. What's going on for you in the coming weeks? Where can people find you?
On Twitter, I'm ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab. Or I am Chiebert at twit.tv, or better yet, why don't you use Twiet at twit.tv, and that hits all the hosts. My life is basically packing. My wife and I are hurriedly packing, trying to get the house ready to go on the market for our great move across the country. We're literally going from one end of the United States to the other. I'm going from Kaneohe, Hawaii, over to Orlando, Florida one day soon. So looking forward to hearing from you. The gentleman that asked me the question about his senior citizen on consumer wireless, thank you very much. And that actually gave me a little piece of the puzzle on what's happening behind the scenes. To all of you that write and ping, and even the ones that flame me, it gives me all kinds of great insight into how this industry works and what's going on in your neck of the woods.
Thanks, Chiba. We do like all types of feedback, so definitely keep it coming. We also have to thank Mr. Curtis Franklin. He's the senior editor at Dark Reading. Curtis, what's going on with you in the coming weeks, and where can people find you and all of your work?
Well, I've got lots of great articles coming up over at the Edge of Dark Reading. And as always, you can find out about what I'm writing by following me on Twitter at KG4GWA. Check me out on Instagram at Kurt_Franklin. We'll try to let everyone know about all the great things happening at Dark Reading in as many places as we can.
Thank you, Curtis. Well, folks, we also thank you as well. You're the person who drops in each and every week to watch and to listen to our show to get your enterprise goodness. We want to make it easy for you to watch and listen and catch up your enterprise news. So go to our show page right now, twit.tv/twiet. There you'll find all the amazing back episodes, the show notes, the co-host information, the guest information, of course, all the stories we do during the show. But more importantly, next to those videos right there, you can get those helpful subscribe and download links as well. Support the show by getting your audio version, your video version of your choice, listening in on any one of your devices, on any one of your podcast applications, because we're on all of them, Podcatcher, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, you name it. So definitely go out and subscribe and support the show. It's really the best way to stay on top of your enterprise and IT news, so might as well subscribe. Now, after you subscribe, impress your friends, your family with the gift of Twyatt, because family members, coworkers, we talk about a ton of fun tech subjects here, and I can guarantee they will find it interesting as well. So if not, hey, reach out to us. Definitely Twyatt at twit.tv, or check out our twit.community website and talk to us on there. Now, if you've already subscribed and you're available during the day, 1:30 p.m. Pacific on Fridays, we do the show live.twit.tv. Come see how the pizza's made. Come see the behind the scenes, all the things that go on, the banter, all the fun we have here on Twit. live.twit.tv. And of course, if you're going to watch the show live, you might as well jump in and join all the characters in our live chat room. We have really great conversations each and every week. It's at irc.twit.tv. So definitely jump in and join the fun. Now, if you can't watch the show live, but still want to be part of the amazing community, check out our 24/7 discussion over at the twit.community website. Really great website that's out there. All the hosts are out there. We have lots of great conversations about all different types of tech and other types of stories that are going on there. So definitely join us at twit.community. Remember, you can always follow me at twitter.com/LouMM. There I have all the latest and greatest conversations about enterprise tidbits. I have great conversations with people like you. And of course, I talk about my normal work days at Microsoft, where you can actually go out to developers.microsoft.com/office and check out all the latest and greatest ways to customize your office experience to make it more productive for your organization. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to Leo and Lisa. They continue to support us each and every week of doing this week in enterprise tech, and we couldn't do it without them. Of course, all thank you to all the staff and engineers at Twit. And of course, also thank you to Mr. Brian Chiebert one more time, because he not only is our co-host, especially today, but he's also our tireless producer. He deals with all the bookings and the plannings and the PR people, and we really just couldn't do the show without him. So thank you again, Chiebert, for all your support. And of course, thank you to our editor, Victor. And of course, thank you to Mr. Ant Pruitt today. He is our TD for today. Really excited to have you, Ant. How's everything going? Are they getting you onto the TriCaster? Getting used to it?
It is unbelievable in this booth, man. Goodness.
Well, we're always great to have you here. Thanks for being here. And of course, until next time, I'm Louis Maresca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.
Want more Twit? Well, check out Smart Tech Today. It's at twit.tv/STT. It's the show where Matthew Casinelli and I cover everything there is to know about smart tech. It's automation, it's connected devices, it's smart home, it's all those goodies and so much more. We get the news, we get the latest devices, we do reviews, everything. You got to check it out. twit.tv/STT for Smart Tech Today.